Welcome to the 113th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And on Darren Pattinson's 40th birthday, welcome to the podcast that celebrates all one test wonders. The more improbable, the better.
So it's been about 2.5 months since we last recorded an episode of Reverse Threat Radio. Firstly, our sincere apologies. Andy, what's your excuse?
So my excuse is that I got married, which is, you know, a fun, happy...
sorry. Anyway, sorry, go on.
A fun, happy excuse. Your excuse is less fun, less happy, more dramatic.
It is more dramatic. I managed to actually put myself out for the cricket season already before it's even started by sort of mangling my right hand a bit and managing to sever some tendons in my thumb, which has been quite a voyage of discovery. But there has been a hell of a lot of cricket to keep us going in the meantime. There's been a World Cup. We're recording this immediately after the first day of the Ashes. We've been reveling in Rory Burns's gritty century, which he said was inspired by meeting the 2005 players that made him want to run through a brick wall, or feel like he could run through a brick wall. Now, I don't want to draw any direct comparisons between running through brick walls and your wedding, but what was one of the things that was very beautiful about your wedding was the fact that we had an opportunity to play cricket together. And I think everyone would appreciate the fact that Andy actually carved out time in his wedding to have a cricket game. That was something that was probably a bit essential for you.
I was always determined there was going to be cricket there, and there was a cricket bat on the invite. But it looked like, in true sort of British fashion, that rain had stopped play. It sort of rained on and off, and I was pretty confident, you know, the pitch will be the sort of lump of grass we had would be too wet. But you know, at the decisive moment, the clouds cleared. It came out. A few of us headed out for a pitch inspection. The verdict was playable. I went and fetched the stumps. And what was interesting to see was the sheer childish joy, particularly, admittedly, for the most part, on the male guests. But we had, you know, lots of people involved who all made their way over. It was a pretty intimidating fielding arrangement for any batsman.
It was a bit of a cauldron, wasn't it? You know, there were a lot of spectators. I haven't played in front of a crowd that big for a while.
Well, and I think as well as the spectators, there was sort of at one stage about 10 fielders on the offside alone, which meant sort of your creative shot making was kind of reined in a little bit. I felt it was exactly right, very high pressure with that crowd. I managed to get a few, you know, eye-catching drives for the audience. That was really what it was all about.
But and your new wife made an appearance as well.
Well, yes, and that really was... my wife is talented in many, many ways, although ball sports have regularly not been one of them. So for her to come out and confidently get on the front foot and drive the ball, a highlight being that when she was caught, the offending fielder was loudly booed by the crowd. What else must you have on your special day than a game of cricket?
If anything's going to set you up for a happy life, then surely it is that. If you can play cricket with your new wife, then surely you can do anything. You can get through anything. The World Cup. So we literally have not spoken since the World Cup a couple of weeks ago. My first question is, do you actually reckon that we really won the World Cup? Do you feel, as an England supporter, like we won the World Cup?
Well, there's this interesting point that if you look at the question of who was the best team in the world, I'm very comfortable that England deserved to win it in that sense. They felt like the deserving winners in that sense. I must admit, on the evening after the game, I felt oddly a bit... I mean, it was an extraordinary game. It was hard to say, hard to add anything more to it. But I did feel a lot more sorry for New Zealand than I expected. I thought they'd played wonderfully, and I thought they had... Whereas England, aside from, you know, the extraordinary performance from Stokes and others, had probably underperformed a little bit from their sort of capability. You felt that was a New Zealand team that got every single bit of talent out of them, you know, particularly in that bowling performance. So yes, I was left feeling incredibly sorry for them. But what was the perception? I mean, you know, you've now been back in Australia I mean, I guess less grumbling there because this wasn't England beating Australia in the final. But has there been a sense in Australia that England are somehow slightly undeserving winners?
Well, it was odd because I actually went to watch the beginning of the final in the pub. It happened on a Sunday night, so it started at about 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, and I went to watch the first 4 or 5 hours of it in the pub, and the pub was totally deserted. Just no one was really interested, and so that was odd for a start. The second thing that was quite interesting as an England fan, because I had exactly the same reaction that I did, sort of think poor New Zealand, and I thought that really classy. Firstly, I thought that Kane Williamson was particularly classy in the way that he kind of just accepted that it was what it was, but then that Ben Stokes, did you see, was actually nominated as the New Zealander of the Year, which I thought was a good indication of their sense of humour. If it had been Australia, I asked myself the question, if it had been Australia in that situation, Australia had been, you know, beaten by an arbitrary rule at the end of a super over, I reckon I would have just been going, well, that's the rules, sorry guys, you've just got to take it. That's just it. We've won it. We've genuinely won it. But it was something about the fact that it was the New Zealanders that made it seem quite so ridiculous that ultimately it came down to the arbitrary question of boundaries scored, which actually I think is an odd way of, you know, who's to say that beautifully nurdled twos or threes in the gaps throughout an innings is any worse than hitting boundaries? Why not, you know, use wickets, for instance?
You're quite right. You are... By creating that rule, you are basically taking a sort of moral stand and saying big hitting is best. I think what probably hasn't been said enough is that in relation to the weirdness of that rule, it was understood. Obviously, there was not, it wasn't, you know, both teams knew that was the rule. So New Zealand knew going into the Super Over.
True, they needed sort of 16 rather than 15.
So it was fair in the sense that everyone knew what they were dealing with. I mean, I think obviously the extraordinary moment has been analysed to death, the Stokes collision. One where I think it would not be extraordinary to me that there is some attempt to reconsider the rules in the light of that.
But also that I feel more with the Stokes one, I feel more that that's just cricket, you know, that kind of thing could have happened in the second over and no one would be talking twice about it. It's just that it so happened to happen at the end of the game. And that's what I thought was quite disappointing about the super over rule was, you know, and you can imagine that it just happened in some lengthy ICC meeting where they were sitting around for 4 hours discussing various rule changes and blah, blah, blah. And at the end, someone piped up at the back of the room, oh, what happens if they're tied after a super over? And, you know, they're all keen to get off to lunch or something. And so, oh, well, whatever, we'll just decide it on boundaries. Now let's move on. And so it was that thing, the arbitrary. I mean, cricket is a wild and wonderful game with all of these quirks and, you know, X, Y, Z. And I think we all accept that as a beautiful part of the game. And so the Ben Stokes thing worried me less in that context than the arbitrary rule about the, you know, about the number of boundaries scored that ended up deciding it. And actually, when we were going into the final, I did actually think to myself, you know, if New Zealand win this, I'm kind of fine with that. I just want it to be a good game of cricket, which is not something I expected myself to feel.
I mean, I think all sports have this challenge that when things are tied in this way, you have to create a somehow slightly artificial mechanism. And I think you have football. And
do you though? Could it not just have been a tied World Cup?
Well, I was actually going to say, I pondered this afterwards, and I, in the immediate aftermath, actually thought I would have been quite happy with that. There would have been something quite nice, particularly actually having tied the super over as well, to just say, look, we cannot separate these teams. The World Cup is shared. I must admit, there's something about my obviously, like, you know, soft view of the spirit of cricket meant I quite liked that. But I fear that it would have left... I fear it would have left some of us content, but a majority absolutely furious, and somehow it would have been a hollow outcome for many somehow.
But why would it have left, if you didn't have, if you just said after the super over, if it's tied, it's tied, everyone would have gone into it knowing that that was the rule. It's not as though England would have therefore felt cheated because England scored the same number of runs. Look, we could talk around the rules of cricket for hours and hours on end. But basically, what a fantastic... it would be one of those games and one of those moments that we talk about and debate longer than most. And what a great result from a Cricket World Cup that's the case, at least.
It also came at the end of a tournament that we now forget, but early on in the tournament, there was a lot about people saying, God, this is not a good World Cup. You know, the English weather was not playing ball. We had lots of games rained out. The favourites were consistently just winning and winning reasonably comfortably. And then suddenly the tournament did take off. And, you know, the New Zealand-India semi was fantastic. But also there were quite a few of the later group stage games that were wonderful. And England did a wonderful job creating their own drama. I mean, they created a knockout situation for themselves. I mean, having to beat India, having to beat New Zealand to make the semis at all.
We made the World Cup come alive by losing games. And for that, I think, for that alone, England deserve to win it.
From the archives, now the first day of the Ashes series saw Steve Smith make a triumphant and quite remarkable comeback. In this episode, Toby is going to take us back to a truly remarkable comeback that was made in another Ashes by an Englishman in his late 40s.
Back in 1926 that we're going to go. And I reckon this is the first of that series of remarkable Ashes comebacks that have sort of defined the history of that Australia-England rivalry. So by 1926, Wilfred Rhodes had already had a pretty incredible 48-year life and career. He started off as a brilliant spin bowler. He then turned himself into a batsman, actually ending up earning his place in the international team as an opening batsman. And so this was an all-rounder who was kind of forged in fire. He'd been a specialist bowler, he'd been a specialist batsman. He was clearly worth his salt. But he had, a few years earlier, given up his place in the international team simply because he wanted other players to have their chance. He was one of these people who was very interested in coaching. He'd actually become an England coach at that point. He was very interested in nurturing through the next generation.
It's quite an interesting idea in the sense that, I mean, nowadays you would hear players say that, talk about the importance of the next generation coming through, but it's always kind of implicit within that actually they may not be worth their role in the team. And I mean, it's always interesting, that difference, isn't it, between a player whose retirement is not performance-based. You know, that there's still a feeling that if they wanted to, they're still probably good enough to be there. I suppose we've had this a bit with Alistair Cook. You know, there was that similar sense with him.
Particularly because with Wilfred Rhodes, he was still clearly on top of his game. So he'd retired from international cricket, but by 1926, he was still playing county cricket. And that season, he'd taken 115 wickets at an average of 14.86, which is pretty remarkable. And he'd scored over 1,100 runs at an average of 35. And so in that sense, there is, you know, take out of the fact that, you know, his 30-year career leading up to this, it's kind of that Mark Ramprakash situation where you have someone who's just making bucket loads of runs and taking wickets in county cricket. You know, at what point do you think about catapulting them back into the test side? Now, throughout this Ashes series in 1926, the selectors had been really keen for him to play, but he'd actually kept on saying, no, I'm not going to do it. I need to give other people a chance. I'm in my late 40s. I'm going to give other people a chance. The first four tests of the series are drawn. They're played on some pretty batsman-friendly wickets, and so neither side can get the upper hand. Now, England are desperate to win this series. It is a series in England. England are desperate to win. They haven't won an Ashes test in 19 games, and they haven't held the Ashes for a number of years, and they go into the final test at the Oval, and it's decided between the teams that it's going to be a timeless test, so they are going to play it out to a result whichever way they go.
This, by the way, is very interesting in the context of the conversation we've just been having about, you know, the super over, good resolution or a bit artificial. I love the idea that after four drawn tests, they're like, we are not drawing another test. We have a result here. Because I guess you could also imagine a context where if one side felt they were the weaker, you'd be like, well, actually, no. You know, a drawn series would be like...
Yeah, exactly. Reduce it to a two-day test and we'll bat first, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something that is gonna force the hand of both teams, and it seems that it forces the hand of the selectors and of Rhodes. Now, it's not entirely clear why it was that Rhodes was persuaded to take his place. Certainly, from the selectors' point of view, they would simply have been thinking, okay, this game is gonna end in a result, and we need the result to go our way. Why Rhodes came on board is another question, but he does end up making a comeback in that final game of the Ashes at the age of 48. And this comeback is quite heralded. If you read the newspaper and the press from the time, all everyone is talking about is the fact that Rhodes is back in the team. He's the person who's won Ashes series for England in the past, and suddenly here he is returning. England bat first. They make, for a timeless test, what is actually a pretty low score for that day and age, which was 280 in their first innings. Rhodes bats at number 7 and adds 28. And suddenly it feels like one of these moments where there's been so much build up, and then suddenly Rhodes comes along and he can't really, affect the game too much. Australia come out to bat. Rhodes takes 2 for 35 with his spin, so he makes a meaningful contribution with the ball before he fails again, really, in the second innings. But England do manage to put on 436 in their second innings, which means that overall, Australia have 415 to win. Now, one of the joys of timeless tests is that even if it's raining, it doesn't matter. And obviously in that day and age with uncovered pitches, a few days of rain meant that the complexion of the game changes completely. And after the oval pitch gets completely soaked, the scene is set for spin bowling. And could you have a more ideal circumstance than England's greatest spin bowler of the past generation coming back for retirement? It's the last innings to win the Ashes, and here he is taking centre stage.
I think one of the things that just makes you wonder is, for a bowler like that, in an era like that, what was the upper limit age-wise? If you looked after yourself, I think maybe it's a slightly lazy assumption to make, but we're generally, this wasn't the fitness-obsessed era that we maybe have now. So, perhaps there was no reason why late 40s was an impediment. You're not, but he was not bowling at great pace. I guess the thing that's always made, that the point's always made maybe more with batting than bowling, that, your eyes do start to fail you a little bit, particularly, I think, always considered, particularly when facing pace. But perhaps there's no reason at that time why a bowler couldn't just keep going.
Well, I think the only thing that springs to mind is, and obviously from slightly later, from about 10 years later, although playing at the time, Harold Larwood, that brilliant book by Duncan Hamilton, one of the things that really comes across there, and obviously Harold Larwood was a pace bowler who put his body through it, but was the number of overs that bowlers were required to bowl back then. So you would regularly have bowlers, particularly in county cricket, completing about 5 times the number of overs that a frontline bowler would complete now. And so just through the amount of repetition and ditto in an innings, I don't actually have the scorecard in front of me to see how many overs Rhodes bowled in this second innings, but it's not unusual for bowlers to bowl, spells of, particularly spin bowlers, to bowl spells of, 30 overs straight through, particularly in timeless tests. And so I wonder whether one of the impediments to actually playing into one's twilight years would be simply the number of overs that the bowlers are required to bowl. Rhodes comes on in that second innings, and he is the person who actually wins the game for England, spoiler alert. He takes 4 for 44, and Australia are bowled out for 125. And really, it's Rhodes' bowling that does make the difference in that final inning. So suddenly, the fairy tale ending does come alive for Rhodes. And he decides at that point that is going to be his fairy tale ending, that he's not going to play any more international cricket. There was a scene that was very specifically set around that last game of the Ashes, and he says, "No, I'm now going to hang up my international boots, and that was my last hurrah." He does, though, go on to play county cricket for Yorkshire for a couple more years. And what's interesting is that after that last game at the Oval, he never really seems to sort of quite get it back again, as it were. So he plays two more seasons for Yorkshire, and he never makes much of an impression.
Mm-hmm.
So to the review, and I think this is the first time on Reverse Swept Radio that we have read a book that has been born out of a Twitter account. This book is was published in 2015. It's called The Grade Cricketer, and it's by three men, three friends, Sam Perry, Dave Edwards, and Ian Higgins. They are three cricketers who were themselves grade cricketers and joined together to write this offer. Andy, how did you get on with it?
So I instinctively thought that this book was going to fall into the tradition of Isn't Village Cricket a Laugh, which is a genre that we've read lots of books that come into that. And they're quite fun, but they're ultimately quite lightweight. And this book isn't that. It is very funny, but it's also incredibly bleak and incredibly honest. And it, for that, it makes it a much sort of more substantial book. It's a lot about the fact that sport can be intensely disappointing, and also the idea that how a passion for the game can sort of get out of hand and actually lead to a life that's slightly unbalanced. You have the experience of actually having played cricket in Australia. You've played club cricket, and one of the things the book pulls out is the gulf between the sort of nicety of English cricket. I don't think that's true about all English cricket, by the way, but the sort of the cuddly side of village cricket and the toughness of the Aussie equivalent. Did any of that ring true for you?
Well, there was. It's interesting. The book is dedicated for all those who ever dreamed that one day they'd play cricket for Australia. And you read this book and you think, if you ever dreamed to play cricket for Australia, this book will probably make you think twice about that dream. In terms of the depiction of, people who try and dedicate their life to what is essentially the lower rungs of professional cricket, you know, going out there and making it in the leagues, you're absolutely right that it is pretty bleak. And there's quite an interesting quotation about the difference between English and Australian cricket, which I'll just read out, which was, "These guys were starkly different to my teammates back home, not just in appearance, but in what they did for a living. Matt was a 30-year-old surgeon, while Patty was a brilliant young lawyer. James was a history teacher at a posh English school. Robbie was doing a PhD in biochemistry, having received a substantial government grant to aid his studies. It was a far cry from the retail workers and online gamblers I was used to playing with back in Australia." Now, that's a pretty stark way of putting it. And the other thing that does come out of this book is, it's a reflection not just on cricket, but on the lives of cricketers and the considerations and insecurities. And, you know, there's a long passages about the quest to lose one's virginity and how that sort of validates you as both a cricketer and a human being. So it certainly leaves no stone unturned in terms of revealing that side of the game, I think.
Yeah, and I think I guess it's what is now discussed and talked about as the idea of like toxic masculinity, you know, the idea that like men trying desperately hard to be men. The book talks a lot about the importance of a good rig. That is a word that was new to me.
Yes.
So the idea of, you know, being well muscled and well toned, and how that's just an obsession that makes everyone very upset and distressed. But it's this idea, I think, of you can laugh and you can joke about it, but I think one thing that sort of rings true is the disappointment of people who did want to be more often. So there's another line about, "The ultimate grade cricketer will possess the perfect balance of good and not good enough that will haunt them for all of their playing days." I would wager that we've all played with people like that. I mean, I think we're probably in the same category of people who were maybe lucky enough never to be blessed with enough talent to dream too far above our station. But I've certainly played with players who, you know, his line about sort of, "Oh, the contract will come next year." I've played with
yes.
people like that, and he, you know, the haunting, and it makes you realize that these things that for some people are a passion and a pleasure, for others are this kind of slightly unhealthy, kind of an almost infantilizing addiction. It stops people from growing up in some cases.
Yep. And that eternal optimism that comes that the next season will be the one when you make it, which is again quite a you know, in a way it's quite hopeful, but in a way it's also totally depressing when you see how that plays out. And one thing that is, so it's worth pointing out that the book is fiction. It's based on the experiences of these three friends.
Which I didn't know as I read it, which I should say is, I guess, a compliment to the book, that I rather stupidly didn't look at the bios until after reading the book. And it's a compliment to the book that it is so well read and obviously well written and so well based on experiences that I took it pretty much as face value. But you're absolutely right. And is it convincing?
Well, I was going to say, isn't that a reflection, though, of the fact that when it comes down to what the actual day-to-day life of being a cricketer is like, we just have so little idea of that that we're kind of willing to believe anything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the level I play cricket at is certainly below grade cricket, but there was plenty about the internal dynamics of a club that I sort of thought rung true. Although, you know, certainly a club where there's a lot less, I played a club where there's a lot less emphasis on the quality of one's rig. The one bit of the book where I thought, well, this is all a bit too good to be true, is for all the bleakness, there is a sort of redemption at the end. And I won't, you know, won't necessarily spoil it, but there's a sense, I mean, part of the book is about the grade cricketers' slightly desperate relationship with their father, and there's a sort of a kind of redemption there, which I think is quite welcome actually, because I think there was an alternative ending which I sort of saw coming, which was just endlessly bleak, a kind of, you know, a sort of miserable, depressed retirement, which I think I would have found a bit too much. So actually, I'm glad that the authors were kind enough to give their hero a nice uplifting-ish finish.
So on the cover of the edition that I've got, the book is compared to Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch, the kind of defining book on football fandom. Do you think that that's a fair comparison?
Well, funnily enough, I actually reread Fever Pitch earlier this year, and it really is an extremely good book. I get a bit cautious whenever books are compared to Fever Pitch, because it often feels like the lazy, this is a good sports book, so we'll compare it to Fever Pitch. But what it absolutely does have in common is it's about obsession. So Fever Pitch is about the obsession of a football fan, this is the obsession of a player, and it's about the joys and wonders of that, but also the other side, the kind of like darker side. And I think the book actually probably comes down in quite a balanced way on that. It shows the kind of the wonderful side of it, the beautiful moments, what the team means, what actually having some escape from daily life means. But it is also very clear on the downside of that. I mean, you get this idea of someone for whom large parts of their life have just kind of never moved on as a result of this.
So that is The Grade Cricketer. It's published by, someone should have looked this up earlier, it's published by Melbourne Books. There you go. And available wherever you get your books, probably, depending on where you get your books. And that was the 113th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Hit us up on Twitter at Reverse Swept. Find us on iTunes and write hopefully nice words. If you write nasty words, we'll delete them. Actually, I don't think we can censor our own iTunes reviews. But anyway, head over onto iTunes and write us a review. And we promise it won't be another 2 months until we're back behind the microphone.